Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, what we've learned from the January 6th hearing so far. For the last month, committee members have peeled back layers on events leading up to the insurrection in hopes of revealing President Trump's role in the attack on the Capitol. They've questioned witnesses, shared video clips of depositions, and aired never-before-seen documentary footage, some say laying out a roadmap for criminal charges against the former president. Ryan Goodman is a professor at New York University School of Law and co-editor-in-chief of Just Security, an online forum focused on national security. He joined me Thursday, just before the fifth hearing, to help us understand what we've seen so far and what might come next. Ryan, the committee says that Trump had a seven-part plan for overturning the election. Briefly, can you lay out those steps for us? I know that Congresswoman Liz Cheney did that right at the beginning of the hearing.
Yeah, so at the beginning of the hearings, she says there are seven parts and that we're going to get evidence of all of them. So here's how this goes. So one is engaging in the effort to spread false information, fraudulent information to the American public. So the big lie.
Yeah.
Second is corruptly using the Justice Department to try to overturn the election. That includes a kind of internal palace coup of trying to install his, for lack of a better term, like co-conspirator, as acting attorney general. That's Jeffrey Clark. So that's the Justice Department piece.
Right.
Third one is pressuring Mike Pence to violate the law and his duties to somehow, one way or another, reject elector votes on January 6th. Fourth is pressure on state officials and state legislators to change the election results. So that's the work of Trump directly himself with the Arizona Republican Speaker of the House and the Georgia state officials in this kind of infamous January 2nd call to Georgia.
Yeah.
Fifth, shouldn't lose track, is the false electors scheme across seven states where Biden had won and Trump himself and the Trump campaign, especially with Giuliani, organized the seven-state initiative to get their people in those states to falsely say that they are the rightful, duly authorized electors, sign documents that they submit to the National Archives saying that they are the duly authorized electors of their states and that Trump won their states in order to basically gum up the works and give a predicate for members of Congress and in their mind, potentially Pence, to say, oh, now these states are disputed, so I can't execute a certification of the election. Six is the incitement of the mob onto the Capitol and the insurrection.
Right.
And then the seventh one is failing to come to the assistance of members of Congress once the violent assault was underway.
Now, as you and I are talking on Thursday morning, there's another hearing scheduled for this afternoon. How successful do you think the committee has been thus far in at least partially addressing that list of intentions?
I think the committee's done excellent work, like a grade in presenting a narrative, presenting compelling live testimony, intersplicing it with compelling recorded video testimony, providing new information, new evidence that even people like me as very close observers find to be stunning. And at the same time, introducing Americans and others outside of the United States who have not been paying as close attention to the whole story. The last one's a little bit harder to, you know, see how it's all being absorbed, but I think the presentation is very successful and effective in that regard as well. And then there's, you know, the big question of like, what is the threshold that they need to reach? Like, how compelling is the evidence? Does it reach the threshold that the Department of Justice would require for them to move forward in one way or another?
Tell me, you used the word stunning. What would you regard thus far as the most stunning revelation to you who've been looking at this for quite a while?
So I've kind of, in my mind, I have three pieces, bombshells in a sense. And each of them, I think also you could say, goes with three of the most important witnesses to emerge. So in my mind, it's Bill Barr as the Attorney General at the time saying that President Trump had indicated no interest in the actual evidence. And it's Bill Barr. And so when he says that, you got to think that in the back of his mind, he's thinking according to the criminal legal standard, because those are the words of a criminal legal standard for criminal knowledge or willful ignorance of the facts. That was one. Second one was Vice President Pence's General Counsel Greg Jacob saying that on January 4th, Trump was told to his face by his own lawyer that the Pence plan was illegal. And his lawyer is basically the only person left in town suggesting that it was legal. So that to his face, Trump is told by his own legal counsel that it's illegal and pursued it anyway. And then number three is total surprise, Rusty Bowers, Republican Speaker of the House of Arizona, discussing the direct communications with Trump to try to get him to replace Biden electors with Trump electors, and Mr. Bowers repeatedly telling Trump, Giuliani, and Eastman, no, that would violate my oath. I will not break the law.
You know what I find absolutely amazing is certainly Bill Barr, among others, who's already said if Trump runs again, he'd vote for him, even though he said that Trump had no interest in the evidence. I also wonder whether Bill Barr is trying to make the case that the president was somehow out of his mind and therefore should not be prosecuted because he wasn't thinking straight.
Yes, I think Bill Barr's a slippery character. And I also think along the lines of what you've just said, that the Justice Department would need to think three times or more before they ever thought, okay, we're going to proceed with a case against Donald Trump and our witness is going to be Bill Barr, you know, one of our key witnesses. Like, is that a reliable witness? Is he going to go further down that path of, oh, you know, I actually thought the president was detached from reality. He wasn't really understanding that he had lost.
Yeah.
I do think, though, that Barr is, first of all, locked into his testimony. So for whatever testimony he gave to Congress, he's now locked in. And if he were to try to waver from it or then start to undermine it in a material way, then he actually risks himself getting in trouble with having made false statements to Congress. So he has to kind of go according to what he's already said. I did also think that there was a strange way in which Barr had said that, and I don't know if I'm reading this too technically and literally in a sense, like his actual words, he chooses his words so carefully. He basically says, if Trump believed this garbage, then I would think he's detached from reality, which is true. I think we can all agree to that. If Trump believed the garbage about election fraud that he was being presented with and himself producing, then he's detached from reality, if he truly believed it. And then Barr says, on the other hand, when I try to present him with evidence, he had no interest in the evidence. And then he also says, I decided to leave because he was not, quote unquote, listening to me and the other cabinet secretaries. At that point, what's the point? And that sounds like Bill Barr talking about willful blindness or deliberate ignorance. In other words, even if you can't prove that Trump knew he lost, if you can prove that Trump was willfully blind, didn't want to, turned away from the facts. I think that helps support that. And there's a lot of other contributing information and evidence that would support that. And I should also just bracket, that's one path towards criminal liability. There are multiple others, and multiple others that are not predicated whatsoever on what was in Trump's head as to whether or not he won or lost.
Such as,
even if Trump genuinely thought he won, he cannot take the law into his own hands. He cannot pressure Mike Pence to violate his official duties to try to overturn the election. He cannot threaten the Georgia Secretary of State, both with criminal sanctions and with physical harm, in a sense of saying that you'll be endangering yourself in order to try to find the votes in Georgia. Those are a couple examples. There's another one as well. There's a law that people haven't focused on as much, but it's been charged by the Justice Department against Oath Keepers and Proud Boys, which is inducing an official to not discharge their duties. That's Mike Pence. Doesn't matter whether Trump thought he won or lost. Another one would be the false elector scheme, potentially. Even if you thought you won the election, you can't produce fake documents and submit them to the National Archives.
What about fundraising for his so-called legal defense? Some $250 million that apparently he's used for himself.
Yeah.
In part.
So I should say that this area of law is not my specialty, but I do think a couple things about it from what I see from the experts that write about it as well. It seems like it would be, if the allegations prove true, it'd be straight up wire fraud. And with plenty of precedent of cases being brought like that. You know, some of the other things we've talked about, there's not plenty of precedent because it's so gargantuanly unprecedented what he did. But this would not be on the form of an unprecedented criminal activity. So one is wire fraud. Two is, the only thing I'd say is, you know, we've seen this movie before in which Trump is very, very good about not having his fingerprints directly on the crime. And the ways in which he's run his corporation and other things like this, those kinds of criminal prosecutions might fall apart if the target is Trump himself. It sounds like there's a lot of information out there that the campaign was doing this, but can they then bring it right to Trump with criminal trial-worthy evidence? That's a second-order question. I'm not sure that would be met.
Of course, the Attorney General is being very tight-lipped right now. We have no idea what he's thinking, what his plans are, and I presume you wouldn't guess.
I'm willing to guess or speculate off of one piece. And that one piece is that they are investigating in one way or another the false electors scheme. So that we do know from the New York Times reporting and from CNN's reporting, including direct quotes from some of the grand jury subpoenas that the Justice Department has sent out to multiple states, that they're asking people who were part of that scheme for any communications they had with, quote, any agent of Donald J. Trump. So that's one piece, but I think that's just a small piece. We have no idea, really. They could be engaging in a criminal investigation. They could be doing nothing otherwise. And I could even see a reasonable person saying, yeah, they've picked that piece because it'll come to nothing. That's not going to really produce something. And they were kind of under pressure to do it because some state attorney generals referred the cases from their false electors to the Justice Department. So they felt they were pushed in a certain sense that they needed to do something. So they're investigating it. Still, even there, difficult to know what's what inside, you know, I'm talking about people's heads inside Merrick Garland's head.
Exactly. So considering how far these committee hearings have gone thus far, what do you think the American people are thinking? How are they being affected by these hearings?
So I think the hearings appear to be breaking through, in part based on some of the public polling. And I think that's in part what I had anticipated to some degree, which is having live witnesses is a theater for Americans. Like, we see that and we see trials as something that is a spectacle that people gravitate towards. The hearings are somber. I think the committee is doing a very good job of leading by the facts, not engaging in rhetorical flourishes or grandstanding. There's no circus because you don't have the likes of Jim Jordan spewing disinformation at the same time. And except for maybe one witness, I believe it's a string of just Republican after Republican after Republican after Republican witness. And then the last witness, the one particular witness, we don't know her affiliation. And I think that also potentially breaks through. There's, you know, social psychological evidence that suggests that people do filter information in such that they don't really process it unless they are sometimes given somebody that they identify with from their in-group who is then giving them the information, and then they process it differently. And we've had just, you know, person after person after person from Trump's top leadership and his campaign and other Republicans.
So, Ryan, in your opinion, did Republicans make a mistake by refusing to participate on this committee, with the exception of two?
Gigantic. I think it's a gigantic mistake. Gigantic. I mean, they could have done what they've been doing for years, which is really mucking things up in a way, getting sound bites out there that would then be reproduced on right-wing media, for example. I thought Jim Jordan, like in the impeachment hearings, was just playing to that audience. And all Kevin McCarthy needed to do was just pick people who are like not themselves directly implicated in the, you know, the attempt to overthrow the election, like Jim Jordan. Like, that would, so he put in poison pills in a certain sense. Pelosi didn't reject all of the people that he put forward, just the folks that were basically under investigation themselves. So yes, I think what a miss. And I believe, you know, there's some reporting on Trump being very upset with, or at least saying that he's upset with McCarthy. Now, who knows? Maybe he himself advised McCarthy to go down this path. But yeah, it's I think it's a major mistake for them in terms of how they usually try to use the information environment.
I gather that first hearing, which was in the evening, gleaned an audience of about 20 million people. That's gone down since the hearings have moved to daytime. Are Trump supporters paying any attention to these hearings?
Based on some of the polling, it sounds as though there is like a center middle that is movable, and people are either saying that Trump is responsible for, or that the DOJ should, the Justice Department should prosecute people who are responsible for the insurrection or trying to overturn the election at higher numbers. And then Fox also started to carry it. You know, they didn't carry the primetime one.
Right.
And it's also for me very difficult to know about the folks who tune in immediately while it's going on live versus there's so many people who then still get their information from the reproduction of clips that are either produced in prime time in the evening by cable news shows and the like, or on social media. So I think that, and it certainly seems like the Republicans and Trump are on their back heels, that he's very upset. And one thing about Donald Trump is he very, very, very well understands the media environment, information environment. So I think he must, in a certain sense, think that he might be losing. And I think this is a remarkable time in which it's happening because we're on the cusp of a Republican primary with at least one strong competitor to Trump. So I do think there's interest within the Republican Party to have some of this play out. I think Mitch McConnell has expressed that kind of interest over time about the Select Committee in particular. And there's recent polling on, you know, DeSantis doing pretty well in New Hampshire. Better than Trump, I should say, not pretty well. So I think that there is this moment here in which there might be more of an appeal and less of an interest in the Republican machine pushing back so hard against the Select Committee. And Maggie Haberman from the New York Times recently said something like that on her Twitter feed when Trump put out a statement. She said he's putting out a statement because nobody else is. Nobody else is doing that kind of counter-programming for him. So I think that's another indication that they're on their back heels.
The committee has had an individual from Hollywood help to prepare these hearings. Tell me the importance of that.
So I think that the importance of that is that it is important to weave together a story, to choreograph it, to present it in vivid detail, and to take out extraneous pieces so that you have a plot that moves through each of the hearings, and each hearing is like a chapter in a book. I think they've just done it marvelously, even to the point that people are joking on social media about the postponement of the final hearings. It's like, oh, an interruption in your favorite show of the season, and you have to, you know, everybody's going to talk about it until the next part of the show starts picking back up. So I think that's one part of it that's just remarkable, and it's partly because of our multimedia diet that we're in these days, that they can present it that way. Because the other kind of analogy in a certain sense is that the 9/11 Commission brought in a historian who was a beautiful writer and wrote the 9/11 Commission report in such a way that was a very moving narrative. I'm pretty sure the committee is also cognizant of that for their written report at the end of the day, but they've obviously demonstrated the ability to do this through visual presentation as well.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Brian Goodman, law professor at NYU and co-editor-in-chief of Just Security. I think it's been just fascinating to watch as each chapter unfolds. But some people have said that the hearings are too narrowly focused on Trump himself. Do you believe that?
I do in different ways. So the hearings do seem to be narrowly focused on individual number one. And then you can easily bring out the circle in terms of other people who could be criminally liable and there should be held accountable. John Eastman. We've had pretty good evidence on him. The next person is Mark Meadows. You know, I know from some of their transcripts that they've produced before courts, there's much more evidence of Mark Meadows, but we haven't seen that much presented. And then the seven-state scheme of the false electors, that's a very organized conspiracy in a certain sense. And we just haven't gone deep on that because it's been so focused on Trump. And then the other piece that I was saddened about when they started announcing their hearings, because I could see the writing on the wall, is that there's no public hearing on the massive intelligence failure and the failure of the FBI with respect to anticipating the attack on January 6th. I think that big question is like the big question for 9/11, like what happened that there was such an intelligence failure? And in this instance, that it's about domestic terrorism, it's about white supremacy, it's about a current threat to our country of political violence coming from these racist and militia groups, and that's not a part of the public hearing, which is a very important public interest to get to the bottom of that. But they're, pretty narrowly focused on individual number one.
But is it your understanding that only Donald Trump had the wherewithal, the right to call out the National Guard, to call out forces that would take down this kind of destruction that was occurring?
On January 6th, once the destruction is occurring, in a certain sense, he doesn't have to do anything further because he's already delegated authority, for example, to the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of the Army over the National Guard. They don't need to go back to him. And in fact, they've testified in the Senate, House, and in for an Inspector General's report, they didn't feel like they had to communicate with the president that day because they thought they had the authority, as one example of that. But he could have done more, and Vice President Pence, we now know, is on the phone trying to rally all of this to happen. Vice President Pence is speaking to Secretary of Defense, like, where the heck are you people? We need you here now to clear out the Capitol. And Trump is the only person, the only human being on the planet who could call his supporters off, and he wouldn't do it. And we now have statements, what sounds like it's going to come from White House aides, that Representative Cheney mentioned, where Trump says that his supporters are doing what they should be doing. And when he knows of the chance of hang Mike Pence, he says that his supporters may have it right. Mike Pence deserves it. You know, and we already knew before the hearings that he had said something similar to Kevin McCarthy, that the supporters obviously care more than Kevin McCarthy does, he said to Kevin McCarthy. And he's actively resisting his aides and his daughter and others telling him, please put out a statement to call them off. And he only reluctantly puts out a statement to tell them to be peaceful, notably not to tell them to leave the Capitol, to disperse, which is what he was being asked to do.
It makes me wonder, and this is more of a political question, how has Mike Pence's image been affected by these hearings?
It's a great question, because I think, you know, the word I had in my mind when I was watching the hearing that was about the pressure campaign on him is that he's being lionized. And then I think that is probably the most popular word that's been used to describe what they did to him in terms of lionizing him and speaking of his, you know, virtues and only his virtues in that hearing, and having both Democrats refer to it that way and Republicans and the witnesses. So I do think that he has an opportunity, if he wanted to seize it, to have that be his mantle and recognize in a certain sense that some of Trump's base are never going to come around to embracing him after what they consider to be a betrayal. On the other hand, he doesn't seem to have interest in that. That's why he's not in the hearings. You know, he could have shown up. but I think that he's still trying to maintain this line of that he and Trump accomplished so much in 4 years, so that's why, you know, vote for Mike Pence for president in the Republican primary and the general, you know. And also just one other piece on that is the conspicuous absence of his chief of staff, Mark Short, from the hearings. So there's a lot of reporting that the committee was expected to send Mark Short a request for him to also appear, and then he doesn't, and he's not there. And, you know, I saw him as a talking head. He's a commentator on Fox News watching the hearings. Before that particular hearing, they asked him, like, oh, you know, what about the evidence that's being presented that Trump said hanging Mike Pence was a good idea, that he deserves it? And he tries to immediately pivot to this thought of, oh, the 4 years of what Mike Pence and Donald Trump achieved together. So, you know, it's politics. It's politics. They're running on that. That's their angle. They don't want to alienate the base.
So you don't believe that the committee will call Mike Pence?
I don't think so. I think there's a dance going on in which they would call him if they knew he would come, but they're not going to subpoena him. For example, and they have said, like, on when interviewed, they have said, oh, no, of course, we'd welcome him to come. But I think he would have to tell them that he's ready. And, you know, I did think that that could be a wild card in the sense of he watches the hearings as they go along. He maybe watches the polling as that goes along and then decides whether or not he wants to come forward. These things are dynamic. Something like that could happen, especially now that the committee has elongated the timeline of the public hearings.
How much has it elongated the time period? What's going to happen as we go forward?
So it's difficult to know. They were supposed to have this kind of like capstone, in all likelihood, prime time hearing next week as the sixth and final public hearing. And it would be about, in part, the militia groups and what Trump did on January 6th, especially once he's in the White House, back in the White House while the riot's ongoing. And now they've postponed it, and it might be two hearings coming in July. They've said that officially, that if their follow-on hearings will be in July, which in some sense is just around the corner. So you could say maybe all they're doing is hopping over 1 week. But it seems very credible to me that they're doing it because more information is coming in. You could see it at the end of different hearings where they said, you know, we want more people to come forward. And then I think many people who might be just on the fence as to whether or not they present evidence to the committee might look and see, oh my goodness, the witnesses who are whistleblowers are treated so well, both by the media and by the committee. They're not trying to tarnish them or treat them unfairly. This is a very sober moment, and that the committee is succeeding. Like, maybe you don't try to hitch your wagon onto a committee that's failing. The committee's succeeding very well. So I do think that's a good reason for them to push back those hearings. They have some time, and then present them potentially with new information that's coming in.
And that takes me to the fact that before the hearings began, Republicans were saying they were totally illegitimate. What are they saying now?
The idea that it's illegitimate, I always thought, was going to kind of crash and burn based on the evidence presented. If the evidence was compelling, then this notion of like procedural regularities would go away, even though the procedural regularities piece, I think, could be exploded as bogus in any case. That it just doesn't sound right. And if anything, I even think it feeds into people understanding, well, my goodness, you're fighting their jurisdiction or their ability to exist because you're very uncomfortable with the truths that they're presenting. I think their other way of now going at it is to say things like, they still try to say it's a Democratic project, a Democratic Party project, and that they are selectively using information from these videotaped recordings, and they're not presenting the other side. It's only like a prosecution being up there, and there's not the exculpating information being presented. So there's something to that in a certain sense, but you have the live testimony. Those people can say anything they want to in the live testimony.
Of course.
And they are not pushovers. That's why I also love the fact that they had Judge Luttig, like the furthest thing down the spectrum from a pushover. And he can say whatever he wants. He has the platform. Greg Jacob as well. All of them. Rusty Bowers. So there's not a good story to be told. That's their problem. But I think that's one of the ways of trying to attack it.
So the hearings this afternoon are featuring Justice Department witnesses. What do you hope to hear from them?
So I've got a problem in answering the question because I am a like ridiculously close observer. And the Senate Judiciary Committee has interviewed two of them and produced the full transcripts of their interviews, which are hundreds of pages long. So I've already kind of consumed that, and I've consumed small little excerpts that the House Select Committee has provided to a federal court of two of the main witnesses. So I kind of have a big preview. But so in some sense, what I want to see is the presentation of what is known by close observers, the degree to which the country came so close to a, you know, lack of a better word, coup. In that Trump reached into the Justice Department to try to pressure them to assist his campaign. All the words coming out of my mouth are crimes. Assist his campaign to overturn the election in Georgia and other states and install his lackey, a conspiracy theorist-minded person named Jeffrey Clark, to install him as the Attorney General because Clark said, I am willing to send a letter to the seven states saying that the FBI has found fraud in the election and you need to decertify. Stunning. And this guy is like an environmental lawyer. He's not like an election person inside the Justice Department. And Trump, in fact, hands him the Attorney General job at a certain point, but then he is forced to climb down because he is told that there'll be mass resignations across the White House Counsel's office and the Justice Department. That's a story. I mean, that on its own, that's the entirety of January 6th, those are crimes, and I think that story will be told by these individuals for the American public.
That will be worth watching, I must say. So the committee has now announced They're extending hearings into July in light of new evidence. What do you suppose that could be?
So we have one piece of what it might be, a video documentarian who was given high-level access to the Trump family before, on, and after January 6th. And it sounds like he has, you know, audio and visual recordings. So that they need to go through all of that. I don't think they would want to, for example, some of it might just be out of just due diligence. They don't want to present something that then might be contradicted by information that's on his tapes. They want to have all the information possible before they move forward. So it doesn't even necessarily mean that there are these kind of necessary bombshells or very incriminating or other enlightening information. Just they've got to be very, very sure as they move forward. I think that's one piece. And then it does sound like there are other witnesses who are coming forward. So the New York Times reported that recently, and I don't know if recently means, you know, only after the hearings began, but it sounded that way. Recently, a communications director has testified to the committee that Trump said to her, how could I have lost to Biden? So he admitted privately that he had lost to Biden, even though publicly he was saying he won. You know, if that's happening, if people are coming forward, I think, you know, the last hearing we had earlier this week, at the very end, it was a poignant moment where Republican Vice Chair Liz Cheney says to the Republican former White House counsel, "We want your testimony, and we know you did the right thing. We know from all the other witnesses you did the right thing time and again. We, the public, the American people, history needs your testimony." Maybe he comes forward now. I mean, I think there's something like that. And if he doesn't, others might hear that calling too. So I think that's, there's a very good chance that that's what's happening in behind the scenes, though it's, you know, difficult to know.
Is there anything else you'd like to say that I have not asked you about?
Thanks. I mean, the only thing I think that it's really good for people to have in the back of their minds is that accountability is not only at the Justice Department, but also at the state level. I think there's a very high likelihood that the Georgia Fulton County District Attorney indicts Trump based on Georgia state crimes. And that's just like soliciting the Secretary of State to engage in election fraud or tampering. And I think that part of what is so helpful as part of public education in terms of what the committee has done is pave the way for the public to better understand the legitimacy of her action if she does decide that there's evidence there to indict. And that might be the way in which at least a first very meaningful step in accountability comes about in the country. And I think that, so to me, like when I watch the hearings, I'm listening for the words Fulton County, Georgia, because they're presenting a lot of evidence that's directly relevant. And they're presenting evidence that's indirectly relevant, like, hey, he did the same thing in Arizona.
So out of these hearings, and you'd have to be looking into the future, what do you hope will come?
So I guess I'll put it this way. It's somewhat of a modest hope. I hope modestly that at a minimum, the Justice Department has a open, robust criminal investigation. So there's a lot of talk about, is the committee producing enough information that you can say Trump should be indicted? I think we even just need the threshold thing answered, which is Merrick Garland has to have opened a robust, full-blown criminal investigation. The evidence presented crosses that mark 20-fold. I just don't think there's any doubt about that. So for purposes of accountability in our country, at a minimum, we have to have that. And then the Justice Department needs to follow the evidence wherever it leads. And so if they then find that they have enough that can prove in a court beyond a reasonable doubt that crimes were committed, then they need to indict. But I'm just this bare minimum of a threshold for a full-blown investigation, I think, is what I'm hoping for. And so far, it seems like the committee is presenting us with unmistakable evidence that that should happen.
Ryan Goodman, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Ryan Goodman, professor at the New York University School of Law and editor-in-chief of Just Security. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.